everyone. This is Mark Movsesian. I'm the co-director of the Center for Law and Religion at St. John's. And I'm joined once again by my colleague and the center's co-director, Mark DiGirolami, for another episode of Legal Spirits, which is our podcast series on cases and issues in law and religion. You can find past podcasts archived on iTunes and also at our website, lawandreligionforum, that's one word, .org. Well, so this is an exciting day for us. Hi, Mark. How are you?
I'm good, Mark. How are you doing?
Okay, thanks. We're joined for the first time today by a journalist, and we're joined by an excellent journalist in the religion sphere. This is Kelsey Dallas, who is the national reporter on religion for the Deseret News. Kelsey came to her career as a journalist by a uniquely academic route. She has a master's degree in religion from Yale University, where she studied, among other things, systematic theology. And that Kelsey, is something more than either of the two Marks can say. We have been reading her very interesting and balanced work on law and religion controversies for a while now, and we thought it would be a nice change to discuss some of these matters with a religion journalist and see how these stories, these cases that we're always talking about, would be seen from the perspective of a journalist. So the plan today actually is we'll say hello to Kelsey in just a second, and Kelsey will ask you to tell us a little bit about your background, how you got interested in issues of religion and politics, as well as law and religion. And then after we do that, we'll discuss the church closure controversies. This is the main issue right now in America, church closures during a time of coronavirus. We actually talked about this in a past podcast from the legal side, but we'd like to hear what you have to say about this because you're out there actually speaking to church leaders and religious leaders who are dealing with this problem. And then we'll talk about some other major law and religion issues, including the Little Sisters case, about which you've written recently, and perhaps some other controversies if we have time. So first, Kelsey, welcome to Legal Spirits. And you have an unusual background for a reporter. You came, as I said, you came to journalism through academia. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that? How did you come into the journalism profession?
Well, yes, thank you so much for having me. I often listen to Legal Spirits when I'm preparing my Supreme Court coverage, so it feels like I'm returning the favor to come on as a guest. So I didn't decide on going into journalism until late in my grad program. I really just loved studying religion and wasn't great at sort of figuring out what that would look like professionally, but I knew that I wouldn't really be well suited for a PhD program, and so I talked to some professors who really encouraged me to look at journalism as an opportunity to continue learning something new every week or even every 2 days, sort of diving into different issues.
Well, you say, in fact, on your website, I saw, or somewhere I saw this, that you actually think of yourself as a student still.
Yes, I always think of, I approach interviews as sort of like, what am I most curious about learning on this topic? And so I sort of think of it more as like, what do I want to teach and pass on to others instead of just maybe what has the most juicy news value right now in this moment.
Yeah. So since you've written about religion, both in an academic vein and also now in a journalistic vein, what differences do you see in those two? I mean, is it different to approach a law and religion story as a journalist than it is as an academic? And how is it different?
Well, I do think it's definitely different. And I used to get in trouble back when I first started as an intern at the Deseret News because I used way too big of words and it sounded a little too complicated. And so that's step one, is that when you're writing for a general audience, you need to make sure you're toning down your specialized language and making sure someone who's never read that topic before can dive on into it. You also need to be careful about the tone of your writing, that you're sort of, you're not making an argument necessarily because you're just sort of piecing together what you've learned from different experts. And it's not about some opinion that you've come to. It's really just about their experience of the subject.
Yeah, well, that must be hard to do, Kelsey. And actually, one issue that sometimes we see with journalists is they don't take that approach. In fact, they do have an opinion or a kind of agenda they're trying to drive. So, and of course, as scholars, we always have a position and an agenda. But how do you avoid that as a journalist?
Oh, see, I'm sort of laughing when you say that must be hard because I feel like I'm a very conflict averse person. So I live very naturally in this space that just says, let me explain both sides of this issue. Let me explain where the conflict is. And I really, really have a passion for that sort of end goal of everyone understanding the issue better rather than one side being declared a victor.
Kelsey, how do you choose which stories to cover? How do you decide when you're doing it? And I do think it's one of the reasons that Mark and I wanted to interview you is that we admire your balance in the stories that you cover so much. So how do you decide which stories to cover and which ones are of interest to you? Or do you sort of, you know, follow the kind of literature, the legal literature and what's going on? Or is it a combination of sort of interesting on the ground issues that you spot in combination with the literature? How does that go?
We on the in-depth team here at the Deseret News, which in a sort of previous life is called the national team or the enterprise team, we have regular pitch meetings where we have to say, hey, this stands out at me. And then an editor who may not have that particular obsession with religion as I do can sort of say, is this going to be interesting to a general audience? So what I'm looking for is some element of timeliness and then some unique question that I can ask. So it always helps when the Supreme Court has that oral argument date to say, okay, this is when I need to file this story. But on things like the church closure controversies, all sorts of people were covering it. And so the key there was just for me to come up with some sort of more specific question that was going to make my coverage stand out.
So Kelsey, can I ask you, because when you say, it's sort of interesting, you say you have an obsession with religion. And, you know, for a long time before I started teaching law and religion, I taught things like contracts. I wrote in areas like private international law, whatever. And then I got into law and religion about 10 years ago. And when that happened, I noticed that people started asking me, well, why did you choose law and religion? It seemed like something that required an explanation. Nobody ever asked me, why are you writing about contract law? But why are you writing about law and religion? And so I guess I want to ask you, why religion? What made you interested in this topic?
Well, that goes back all the way to my undergraduate life at the University of Iowa. I was actually an English major and had added economics because I wanted sort of a creative and then math-based major going on at the same time. And it wasn't until my junior year that I was really diving into some religion classes. And it was the first time that I've ever done readings for class and like called my mom or got a roommate to come over just to repeat what I was learning. I was just so hooked on the topic. And I don't know if I have a great explanation for it other than I felt that passion and it just delights me to really think about these different conflicts and how people of faith work through them and how there's so much obviously conflict between different faith groups, but just the tension that happens within faith traditions is just endlessly fascinating to explore.
Yeah, you're right about that. And just the last kind of general background question. So, and how did you wind up at the Deseret News? I guess that's is that your first journalist job?
Yes, because I actually was hired as an intern right out of grad school and then hired full time. I had never come to the West, really. I'm a Midwestern girl and then was in the East Coast for grad school. They have just done a ton of religion coverage at a time when many outlets have had to sort of scale it back. And so we have someone dedicated to covering the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And then I do basically everybody else. And that includes politics and religion and law and religion. And so there's this very long-term commitment to religion coverage that I connect with.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, great. Well, thanks for that background. And let's turn now to the first of the legal issues we want to talk about, and that's the church closure question. As I said, Mark and I did a podcast on this a little while ago, so our listeners have already heard a little bit about the legal issues. But Mark, you want to take over here? Why don't you ask some questions about this?
Yeah, sure. So Kelsey, and actually maybe we can even talk, as we're talking about the church closure issue, we can talk about some of these things that are happening in New York. I don't know if you've heard of them, the sort of dispersal orders that are going on now where groups of people are being asked to disperse as a result of the general closure orders or dispersal orders that the governor and the mayor of New York have implemented. But they all seem to be sort of part of the same category of issue. And you've written some articles over the last few months about how this epidemic is affecting churches and other houses of worship and the fact that, you know, the vast majority of these are closed or they've been closed as a result of the epidemic. So what's your sort of general perspective on this set of controversies? Is it still bubbling? Is it getting hotter? Is it what do you sort of see in the stories that you cover relating to this controversy?
Well, when I first dove in March to the topic of how do we apply religious freedom law to an issue like social distancing requirements, I was fascinated to learn that although we've never been in a situation like this as a country, we're having some very familiar conversations about religious freedom. So it's just come down to how do you balance these protections for faith groups with these other very serious governmental concerns? And it just, like I said, that word balance comes up in almost every religious freedom story I write. And so we started from this place that felt very cut and dry, which was, okay, the government has an interest in keeping us safe. So yes, they can apply gathering restriction to churches, but it's becoming more and more complicated as they're making adjustments. They're trying to reopen. There's been a lot of frustration with different stores that receive the ability to stay open and function normally while the government is trying to say, hey, churches, you can't do anything in person right now. And so it hasn't been quite as much conflict as I expected, but certainly some very intense lawsuits taking place.
That's interesting when you say balance, Kelsey. It's in fact, it's not a surprise, at least from the legal side, to hear you say that that's a word that you see coming up again and again, because it's essentially, it's in the nature of the legal tests that's what we've got, especially for some of the statutory tests for religious freedom. The burden on the believer is balanced against the interest of the state. And you know, Mark and I talked about some of these controversies. Actually, it's funny, the speed with which some of these decisions are happening has kind of eclipsed our capacity to talk about them, because the last time that we got together and talked about one of these cases, the Sixth Circuit had just decided, I think that was right, Mark, it had just decided, maybe it had even not yet decided, that the drive-in church services could not be categorically excluded. That might have happened just after our podcast. And then after that, another decision from the Sixth Circuit came down that basically said, and also in-person church services can't be categorically excluded and shut down with the rest of the businesses and other sorts of activities that are shut down as part of the governor's order. So it does seem to me that things are moving quickly in this area, and that probably we're going to have more fight before everything is said and done. Would you agree with that, Kelsey?
Oh, definitely. And I think I alluded to this, which is that as states begin to reopen, it sort of opens this brand new avenue of types of conflict, because I did a follow-up story from my original, like, how do we apply religious freedom law here, that says, okay, if you're going to open a first wave of businesses, do churches need to be part of that? And the answer I was getting was basically yes, because the more businesses that open, the less of an argument the government can make to say it's absolutely essential that these places are closed down. And so states are very quick to get in hot water when they say, hey, churches don't get to have in-person worships and services until another month or two from now.
Yeah. Yep. Well, I understand that, Kelsey, actually. And that makes sense to me. Although there's another argument that's come up recently that I want to think about a little more. And that is, well, you know, it's not just businesses opening. You want to look and see. So church services are not just like a retail business. I mean, people gather, they stay in one place for a long time. The real question would be, it seems to me, well, is the state opening museums? Is the state opening, you know, theaters? Is the state allowing concerts? Because if they're doing that, then it seems to me it's very hard to say that there's a reason for keeping churches closed. But if they're not opening those places, then maybe there is a reason.
Well, I do want to say that's what I've struggled with when Mark was talking about how it felt like it was impossible to keep up. It sometimes felt like it was impossible to keep up with a faith leader's arguments just within an interview, because it was sort of like they were comparing the situation of a church to an airport or to the grocery store, where in my head, I might have been comparing comparing a church's situation to, like you said, a museum or some sort of community gathering space. And so there was never really this settled idea of who churches were on the same level as, if churches should count as an essential service because maybe a marijuana dispensary counted as an essential service. And so it was just difficult for states to navigate, because I think a lot of leaders said, hey, churches, you can have your essential sort of activities happen online, whereas an airport obviously can't. You can't take a flight that's virtual. And so there's just been a lot of frustration where people don't agree on which types of organizations churches should be lumped in with.
Right. And you see that in the cases too, Kelsey. I mean, so a couple of judges have said, well, just as you say, a religious service can be done online. And so it's not the same as a grocery store. But of course, and I actually, to promote myself, I just made this point in the Liberty Fund piece. You know, some worship services cannot take place online. Mm-hmm. If you're receiving communion in a Catholic church or an Orthodox church, that cannot be done online. So to get back to what Mark is saying, I mean, and what you're saying, this balancing idea can be extremely difficult in a culture in which we don't really share basic ideas of what religion is and what it entails and what its value is. Mm-hmm. That's what I see as a main takeaway from these cases.
I mean, one question I have, Kelsey, just as I listen to you talking, is you could distinguish between two different sets of issues. One set of issues involves the question, what are churches like, just purely from a sort of epidemiological point of view, when comparing them with other institutions, right? So you could say, well, in churches you have, you know, Mark was saying that there are a lot of people who are gathered and they don't move at the same time. But of course, one could tinker with those facts and say, actually, well, you can have social distancing in churches and so on. You could limit the number of people that come in. So are they more like liquor stores and grocery stores? People say, well, for grocery stores, you sort of flit in and out of grocery stores. I have to say that has not been my experience recently with grocery stores, like, because we're being urged in New York not to go grocery shopping. When we go grocery shopping, it's like an event with camels and, like, you know, we have to bring a caravan and, you know, so, I mean, it is a real, I mean, it takes an hour for us to go grocery shopping between when everything is said and done. That's one set of questions. A second set of questions is the essential question, right? The question of what do you need from a church in order to practice your religion? Just like, what do you need from a grocery store in order to get food? Or what do you need from an airport in order to fly? That seems to me a much more qualitative kind of question that will depend on the sort of issues that Mark is talking about. Like, well, how do we think about the goods of religion, right? What do you really, can you just get it in front of your screen? Or do you need to be with other people? Or do you need to be, okay, have to be alone or together? That's, I think, a much more intractable question than the sort of more discrete epidemiological question about what are they similar to, just sort of diagnostically, don't you think?
Yes. And I just wanted to highlight, there's more research coming out confirming this sense that a wrinkle in trying to compare churches to other types of organizations is the role of singing in most church services, the types of physical interaction that often take place, even when it's not hugging, it might be passing the offering plate. There's that research that came out this week confirming that you get in danger pretty quickly when you have people sort of aggressively spitting because they're singing. And so that's what made me feel like, oh my gosh, it's almost like churches do need to be singled out in these rules because they just include such unique activity.
You don't yeah. do that at the grocery store, Kelsey?
Maybe if they're playing a oldies mix.
Yeah, maybe. So Kelsey, could I ask you, because you're talking to a lot of religious leaders, right? I mean, Mark and I, we read cases, but things are often abstract. But you're actually talking to religious leaders. So, I mean, what sense do you get from them? I mean, are they eager to start opening? Are they resentful? Are I mean, are they trying to be prudent? Are they, you know, are they trying to be careful? What is your sense of this?
Well, I'll say although there have been plenty of lawsuits filed and lots of coverage of churches that have tried to defiantly stay open, for the most part, churches are trying to be very, very careful. And even when they get the green light to resume in-person worship, for example, Georgia was one of the first that was sort of like, let's go ahead. So many churches there were saying, we don't anticipate having anything like a normal worship service even this summer, because there are just so many risks that are in play and we need to figure out how to deal with them. And so I think churches are trying to move very slowly and carefully, but they still want to speak up when something seems just out of control or unfair. And so that's where it was important that you highlighted the cases with like the drive-in services, because that was an example of a church trying to work with this new normal and find a way to stay together in person but safely distanced. And yet they still were getting sort of slapped on the hand for doing it. And so I think that's why you saw such frustration in that situation.
Yeah, you see something like that in Italy a little bit, Kelsey. I don't know if you followed it, but in Italy now the government has announced it's going to open up museums and libraries, but it's not going to allow churches to open. And so now the Catholic hierarchy in Italy, which has been pretty compliant, has begun to say, now, wait a minute, how can you open museums and how can you open libraries and you won't allow a mass to be said? So
there's this real frustration where religious leaders want to be trusted to do what's right for their congregation. And so when they're being sort of patted on the head and people are saying, this is for the best for you, you can function online. It's like, no, you need to hear our voice as faith leaders saying that we deserve the freedom to sort of navigate this situation on our own terms.
Yeah, interesting.
And if I could add just one thing, since I raised it, this parallel phenomenon of dispersal orders that is going on now in New York, I think is kind of interesting. So that there are these orders that, you know, you obviously the same kinds of things that we're dealing with. You can't gather in groups of more than a certain number. And you see, I think actually it's a kind of interesting from a cross ideological perspective. Both people, for example, I heard protesting this Samaritan's Purse in New York. And the video that I saw, they were actually quite socially distanced. They were wearing masks. They were more than 10 feet apart. It's a small group of people that was protesting this conservative Christian organization that's administering charity on because they have various LGBT views that the protesters don't agree with. But the protest is a protest. It's First Amendment protected, and because of the breadth of the dispersal order, you inevitably are going to have differences in enforcement. Some of the police are going to enforce this very broad order in different ways, in different contexts. And as that continues to develop and you have different groups protesting different things, groups protesting the shutdown order, groups of all different stripes sort of doing what they want to do to make their voices heard, you're going to have more of these kinds of problems of saying, well, why is the New York government targeting me or my organization? Do they have some kind of issue with my message or something that I'm protesting about, where you see other people who are gathering in various contexts and aren't the subject of dispersal orders? So I do think that there's something problematic in the air, you know, across these various sorts of issues.
Yes, what struck me is that there were so many opportunities at basically every stage of this crisis so far for government officials to sort of slip up and seem to be singling out religious groups for mistreatment. And that'll only continue as we move forward, that sort of the religious leaders and government officials need to be in conversation with each other so that their only interactions aren't negative ones.
Okay, so we have a little time left, and I know another case that you've written about recently is the Little Sisters case. So maybe we could talk just briefly about this. I mean, how do you see this general fight going on about the Little Sisters case, and what are your thoughts about that, Kelsey?
It was sort of surreal to be writing about it once again this month, because I feel like this is the single issue that I have covered the most times over the last 6 years or so that I've been at the Deseret News. So there were certain feelings of deja vu, but it's just that we continue to return to this idea that people on different sides of this case completely disagree about what religious freedom law requires. And I think during oral arguments, you saw that the justices were almost exasperated trying to deal with this conflict and saying, how do we move forward when both sides seem so set in this conflict? They don't feel like they're moving towards some solution.
Right. Well, on this podcast series, we've referred to this case as the Jarndyce versus Jarndyce of law and religion cases. You know, the case that just goes on and on and on and on and never stops. But in some ways, it reflects the same divisions you see with church closures. You just have people on different sides of the issue that see things extremely differently. And also maybe Kelsey, you can comment on this. Again, I'm curious because you're actually on the ground talking to people. You know, when you read the cases, you get the sense that these people just don't even want to talk to each other, really. They think there's really nothing to be said because, you know, their side is right and the other side is wrong. And there's just not a way to bridge that. I mean, how do you find this in talking to these people about the cases?
Yes, I don't think there's a lot of sympathy for the arguments that each side is trying to make. So my best example of that is that if you go back to the Zubik case, where it was like the Little Sisters of the Poor saying that we feel it violates our beliefs to even sort of submit this form that says we're not happy with the contraceptive mandate. And so the government needs to sort of take on the process from here. There were so many Americans that just did not get that. Like, how could that possibly be a violation of your conscience to fill out some sort of form or to enable employees at your company to sort of get this coverage directly through the insurer? And we still haven't gotten over that hump, if you will, that there's still this total confusion about maybe Catholic beliefs around birth control. And so there's not a lot of sympathy for the nuns who are back in front of the court in certain circles of the population.
Right, whose position is, as I understand it, well, even filling out that form makes us complicit in providing these drugs as part of our plan, and why can't you just... And it looked like for a while they were going to be able to do something, right? I mean, it looked like that they could have just funded this some other way, but there doesn't seem to be much...
They did do something. The federal government did do something and gave the Little Sisters what they wanted, but then it was the states... who intervened and brought a lawsuit to say, no, you can't do this. The federal government actually cannot give the Little Sisters and other similar groups what they are asking for. So, I mean, this is the kind of a, there was in some ways a resolution. The resolution was the election of 2016 and a different administration that came in, which I think in some ways goes to the nature of the fight more than just sort of the issue of the form. You know, the form is part of a long sort of suite of fights that have been going on really since Hobby Lobby about this mandate and about the various features of the mandate. So in some ways, I think, Kelsey, you're right that the people are just so entrenched after all these years in their positions. And it's interesting that the Supreme Court, as you said in Zubik, didn't want any part of it, right? I mean, it sort of abdicated responsibility for making a decision and said, well, go work it out. So you wonder whether the court wants to do that again, you know, sort of say, look, we still don't want any part of this at this point.
Right. And Zubik, Mark, was unanimous.
Sure. It was a unanimous punt.
Right. Well, what I wanted to highlight was I really enjoy thinking about in this case is that I think that there are many points along this timeline of the contraceptive mandate battle where people maybe wish there could have been a do-over. So maybe if you ask Joe Biden as part of his role in the Obama administration how that exception and accommodation process should have worked from the beginning, he might outline a totally different setup than what Obama had settled on, the health officials in that Obama administration. Mm-hmm. And now you could say the same thing maybe about the Trump administration. Would this have been a different conversation if they expanded religious exemptions without messing with this moral exemption idea? Because that's what came up to me in oral arguments was even justices that are sympathetic to this idea that there should be broad religious exemptions are a little confused about where this moral thing came from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's very interesting, Kelsey. So we'll keep an eye on that. And I guess just in closing, are there any other stories, Kelsey, on your radar screen? I mean, what should we be expecting to read about next?
Well, I'm doing one more Ramadan story. We're getting close to the end of that holy month of Ramadan for Muslims. And I'm talking a bit about how the coronavirus has disrupted their typical practices and then looking at sort of the virtual opportunities to connect that they're taking advantage of. This is also, as you guys know more than me, this is the Supreme Court heyday where we're expecting rulings all the time. They're wrapping up oral arguments. And so I've got all sorts of cases that I'm sort of watching and trying to sort of write about what their bigger impacts can be. And then in the long scheme of things, we've got the 2020 election quickly approaching, and I'm trying to watch what role religious freedom battles will play in that, and then just religious voters in general, how they'll behave.
Well, we're going to be looking forward eagerly to reading those pieces. We'll read them closely, and maybe hopefully we can get you back on here and talk about some of those other cases some other time. This has been really great. So thank you very much, Kelsey, and thank you, Mark. And for me and Mark DiGirolami, I want to say goodbye for now. This has been another episode of Legal Spirits. You can find past episodes archived on iTunes or at our website, lawandreligionforum.org. See you next time.